Welcome to the Forency Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Soren. Forency is a podcast about Near Eastern history, language, and culture, and is brought to you by Forency.us, the premier language learning website for intermediate to advanced learners of Arabic, Hebrew, and Russian. On this episode of the podcast, I spoke with Professor Gary Rendsburg, who's a professor of Biblical Studies, Hebrew Language, and Ancient Judaism at Rutgers University. He holds the Blanche and Irving Laurie Chair in Jewish History. Professor Rendsburg is an expert on the historical development of the Hebrew language and ancient Hebrew dialects, which was the focus of our discussion. I had a great time speaking with him, and I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today, and I've really been looking forward to it.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Alex. Thanks for having me.
So before we dive into the meat of our discussion, I'd like if you can talk about what initially drew you to study ancient Hebrew and to really dive into the ancient Hebrew dialects.
So I came to the field of Hebrew studies somewhat secondarily. My BA at the University of North Carolina is in English literature, and I had a great interest in older levels of English, so mainly Middle English and Renaissance English, a little bit of Old English as well. And as an English major, you have to do almost everything through the 20th century, but that was where my main focus was. And I also learned through such studies of the great variety of dialects that exist in Great Britain, even in the English-speaking parts of Great Britain, never mind the Celtic-speaking parts like Scotland and Wales. So I was just doing my BA in that field. I was blessed to have two wonderful teachers, including Norman Eliason, who was the doyen of all Chaucer scholars in the United States, and other teachers as well, and thought that I would go on for a PhD in English with a focus in those areas. But I was also taking religion courses, Hebrew courses, Jewish study courses en route, and I had superb instructors in those fields as well. And my senior year, beginning my senior year as an undergraduate, decided to switch from idea of pursuing a PhD in English to pursuing a PhD in Hebrew studies. And off I went to NYU, where once again I was blessed with superb teachers, but most importantly, my main mentor, the late, great Cyrus Gordon, or as we would fondly call him, Cyrus the Great, great professor of biblical studies, Semitic languages, ancient Near East of the 20th century. And I never looked back from there. And on the notion of Hebrew dialects, clearly this is where my BA in English came to meet my graduate studies in Hebrew, because I thought I would pursue some of those avenues in Hebrew studies. When we read Old English and Middle English, we notice a variety of dialects all over England. And it's not even clear to what extent some of these people would have been able to speak to each other in the Middle Ages. So the dialect of Kent in the far southeast and in the far northeast, Yorkshire, and even further north, Northumbria, today called Northumberland, and all sorts of other dialects, the West Country, and so on. People think that small countries can't have lots of dialects, and actually linguistics teaches quite the opposite. Mm-hmm. To this day, England has more, or if you take Great Britain as a whole, has more regional dialects than the United States does, even though the United States is, of course, a much, much vaster land. And some of that is to do with a little bit of the geography, or every county might have its own. And the other great example that we use in linguistics is Switzerland, and we're only speaking about the German-speaking parts of Switzerland. The lore is that every canton has its own dialect. Mm-hmm. And of course, since I also know German, you cannot clearly hear the differences between the southern dialects of Bavaria and Austria versus the northern dialects, especially the northwestern parts of Germany where they speak Plattdeutsch, this low German, which begins to sound a little bit more like Dutch. Mm-hmm. So I started just thinking about all these things. And then when it came time to investigate ancient Hebrew, I moved into that realm. But actually, the regional dialects part came second in my investigation. My first look was at the difference between written and spoken dialects of ancient Hebrew, what we call diglossia in the field. And the model for that, as you know, is Arabic. So it's actually one of the paradigms in the field of linguistics by Charles Ferguson, who developed the concept of diglossia in a seminal article in 1959. So classical Arabic is classical Arabic. It's the language of the Quran. It's the language of all medieval literary Arabic sources. Mm-hmm. We also know that people never spoke classical Arabic. And of course, to this day, that is clearly the case, where modern standard Arabic is the outgrowth of classical Quranic Arabic, which is what is used in writing. And the spoken dialects vary greatly, both vis-a-vis the classical language and from place to place, from Egyptian Arabic to Iraqi Arabic to Palestinian Arabic to Yemenite Arabic, etc. So that was my first thought, was to see if we could investigate what did ancient spoken Hebrew look like, sound like? How did it differ from the classical standard biblical Hebrew, which is used to write the biblical, my dissertation? And actually not my first book, but my second book, like Glossy in Ancient Hebrew, published in 19.
So to go back to your studies in Old English, just out of curiosity, when you're looking at those old manuscripts and those texts, I mean, it's probably very clear that there's a literary language that they're writing in, but then there's dialect that's seeping its way into it here and there, right?
That is essentially correct. There was no real classical standard of Old English in the sense that we have in classical Arabic, for example, or biblical Hebrew. You can almost tell from the literary, and I'm not an expert in Old English, but if I was at one point, it's been too many decades, but you can tell who's writing it. And this is the scholars who work on Old English literature can tell whether a text was written in the Northeast or in the Southeast or in London or in the West Country. Eventually, London dialect, of course, merges as the classical standard, especially in Middle English and Chaucer, which is poetry, not prose, but nevertheless is informed by that literary standard of London for obvious reasons. It was the court.
These seem like they're things that are just human nature and that you can see if you're reading books today written by an author who's writing, you know, who's born and raised in Texas and writing in Texas, he's probably going to use phrases that somebody who's born and raised in New York isn't going to use. And it just seems like a natural human thing.
It is. It's what we all do naturally, sometimes consciously, sometimes subconsciously. As American literature in particular developed over the couples of this country, you eventually get people like Faulkner who are actually writing very clearly in that Southern dialect, and their characters speak in that Southern dialect. And sometimes it's hard to even read a page of Faulkner because of the piece that are there to evoke that language. But this is the wonder of literature. It continues to attract me both in the ancient Hebrew and in the history of the English language, and even into the 20th century, 21st century now, absolutely.
In one of your papers we'll get to this, we don't have to dive into it too deeply now, but I mean, it seems that ancient writers did the same things. I mean, you've written about the biblical writers taking on characters of people from other countries and writing and using those expressions and writing in that style.
Right, and this happens in a couple of instances. If we just take the more familiar narratives of the five books, the Pentateuch, five books of Genesis through Deuteronomy. So there are two famous scenes in, more than scenes, episodes in the book of Genesis, where characters from the land of Canaan move to the land of Aram. One of them is Abraham's servant in Genesis 24, who goes off to procure a bride for Isaac and meets Rebekah at the well, and then brings back Rebekah, who marries Isaac. And the second one is when their child Jacob has to flee the household, and in Genesis 29 through 31, actually goes to live in Aram. So there you have three chapters where he lives with his uncle Laban, meets Rachel, famous story. First is married to Leah by deception, and then eventually marries Rachel. So those two stories, Genesis 24, which is a very long narrative chapter, and then Genesis 29 through 31, set in Aram, the story takes you to the world of Aram. So you begin to hear little Aramaic words here and there in the story. It can't be written in Aramaic. If it were, that would have been unintelligible to a Hebrew reader. Educated people in ancient Israel would have, and we have evidence for this, would have known Aramaic, even in the biblical period. Certainly later on in the post-biblical period, the Jewish people become almost totally bilingual. But in this early period, if you wrote it in Aramaic, it would not have been understandable. But you can throw in Aramaic words here and there. And it's the analogy I use: if we watch a World War II movie, the German, in English, it's all in English, the German soldiers will use an occasional expression like Mach schnell or Achtung. And the assumption is, well, that's sufficient to give you the flavor. I mean, they're speaking English sometimes with accents, but it gives you the flavor of Germans in an English movie, right? So the biblical text does. I mean, one, you know, delightful example is the word for almond. So in biblical Hebrew, the word for almond is shaked, also in modern Hebrew. But in Aramaic, the word is luz. And the only time luz appears as a common noun, it appears also as a proper noun, as another name for the city of Bethel in the Bible. But the only time it's used as a common noun, meaning almond, is in that Jacob story when Jacob living with Laban in Aram. So this is a intentional use to sort of give you the flavor.
Right.
And, you know, the average ancient Israelite know when he or she got to the word or heard the word luz, oh, that's the Aramaic word for almond, unclear. But it's possible just to raise a question mark in the ears of the listener to these stories, which were not read silently. Nothing was read silently in antiquity. All was right. all read out and listened to by an audience. Unclear how a person would have reacted to that, apprehended the word, unknown. But there it is. There's the word luz, which is just a delightful example of how the writer will employ an Aramaic word. And the other example of this is the opposite. When Book of Numbers, when Balaam, who is a prophet from Aram, actually comes to the land of Canaan, and he's brought there by the king of Moab, Balak, and he's supposed to curse the people of Israel, but he blesses the people of Israel. And again, in the Balaam story, an Aramean prophet is speaking Hebrew, but you get occasional Aramaic words and phrases which are just peppering the story for literary delight.
Right. And luz is carried over into modern Arabic also.
So classical Arabic would be luz?
Luz has the same meaning in Arabic dialect now.
Okay, but not in classical.
It might.
That's great. So luz is, I think I knew that, but thanks for reminding me that. So luz becomes is a good Arabic word for
right. So I reached out to you initially because I'm fascinated by how ancient Semitic languages developed, and in particular Hebrew and Arabic. And in searching that topic, I came across a book you wrote a while back called Israeli in Hebrew, and thought, oh, that's a really cool title. So I started diving into that and trying to understand what that was. And what was what you call Israeli in Hebrew?
So Israeli in Hebrew is the northern dialect of ancient Hebrew. So a little bit of historical background first, which is, it's not clear to what extent Israel was ever united as a 12-tribe entity. So presumably a loose confederation of tribes in the pre-monarchic period, worshiping the same God, having the same culture, etc. There was a brief period under David and Solomon when all 12 tribes were united under a single kingdom, according to the way the Bible unfolds this story in the books of Samuel and the first few chapters of Kings. And then it separates. So after the death of Solomon, it divides into two, and you have a northern kingdom of Israel and a southern kingdom of Judah. Judah retains its capital in Jerusalem, the temple in Jerusalem, and are ruled by the descendants of David and Solomon, who were from the tribe of Judah. And the north sets up its own kingdom, and the capital moves around from time to time, but eventually a new capital city is built in Samaria. So those two kingdoms had separate dialects. And the best way to see this is if you look in the book of Kings, starting with chapter 12 upon the death of Solomon, and then through the very, the two kingdoms still exist side by side into 2 Kings chapter 17. When the stories about the kings of Judah are presented, they are written in what we would call standard biblical Hebrew, which is essentially the dialect of Judah in general, or Jerusalem in particular. But when the kings of northern Israel are described in the book of Kings, and that would also include the two prophetic narratives of Elijah and Elisha, both of whom come from the northern kingdom, a different dialect is used. So these stories, which eventually find their way into the canonical book of Kings, emanate, derive from the annals of the kings of Judah on the one hand and the annals of the kings of Israel on the other hand, which the book of Kings actually states for us. And the annals that were kept in Jerusalem would have been written in a different dialect than the annals that were kept.
Is that like when, you know, when it says like, it's pretty much, I mean, not in these words, but it pretty much says like, for more information, go see the annals.
Yes.
Right.
The equivalent of a footnote today. So when any king dies, dozens of them, between the two kingdoms, and it'll say, you know, something like, for more information, go to the annals.
I found that fascinating, just reading that, where it's like, you know, it's right. a religious text, but then it's like, if you want more information, go see this section of the library.
It's wonderful. It's really wonderful. It's like a self-referential, this is where I got the information from. And the Elijah and Elisha stories probably came from some other source, probably not from the annals of the kings of Israel, but through some collection of the what we call the prophetic narratives. So Judahite Hebrew, it's easy to say Judahite Hebrew or Judean Hebrew. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know what to call the northern. Here's the problem. So we all agree on Israel, but what's the adjectival form of Israel in English? So Israeli refers to the modern country of Israel.
Right.
Israelite could be understood to mean the entirety of the 12 tribes, mm-hmm. regardless of who they were, a part of the people of Israel, B'nai Israel in biblical Hebrew. So right around this time, when I was searching for a word, a great scholar at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York, H.L. Ginsberg, wrote a book called The Israeli Heritage of Judaism, in which he tried to show that much of the biblical material emanates from northern Israel. He coined the adjective Israelian for the very reasons that I've just explained, Israeli and Israelite meant something else. Mm-hmm. So I captured that word and just started referring to the Northern dialect as Israeli and Hebrew. And it's a bit of a mouthful, but it's stuck. And that's the term that we still use. You can use the shorthand and just call it Northern Hebrew.
Right.
But what it means basically is from the Northern Kingdom.
When we're looking at, when you're examining these texts and you're identifying different dialects that are describing the history of Northern Israel versus Judah, is the consensus that whoever composed these into the canon was pulling from different texts and kind of smushing them together? Or was it somebody who was writing it and, like you said, had, just like how they color their narrative sometimes in the languages of other kingdoms or regions, was it possible the author was doing that, or were they pulling from something else?
No, I think they were actually, it wasn't coloring so much like in the first examples I gave you, which we call style switching or code switching. Linguists know how to use these terms separately, and I include myself in that. But that was an intentional use of this foreign dialect or foreign language phrases and lexemes and so on by the writer. In this case, I think the writers of the North were writing in their language and the writers of the South were writing in their language, and they were eventually put together in some fashion, a little bit like what we were discussing a few moments ago about Old English. So the Bible comes to us from Jerusalem. So listeners will know the story, but it's worth mentioning it. The Northern Kingdom of Israel came to an end in 721 when it was destroyed by the Assyrians, and the population was exiled to Assyria and other places in northern Mesopotamia and even beyond. So archaeologically, we know the land becomes relatively empty at this time. We also know that a number of people from northern Israel just fled southward to Judah and took refuge in the city of Jerusalem, because once again, archaeologically, we know that the city of Jerusalem greatly expands in the late 8th century BCE, and the population maybe doubled for all we know. I mean, there's expansion in the size of the city and in the population of the city. This is attested archaeologically. So I would assume that those people who fled the north and went south to Judah and sought refuge in the kingdom of Judah in the temple, and those texts would include the portions of the Northern Kingdom annals that we've talked about, but other texts as well. Some of the stories of the judges, which are situated in the northern part of the land, the story of Deborah and Barak, for example, in Judges 4 and 5. And much of the book of Proverbs seems to be written in this northern dialect. We actually have a statement which confirms what I'm stating in Proverbs chapter 25, verse 1, where it actually says that what follows, these are the proverbs that Hezekiah imported into Judah. So there's a debate as to what that Hebrew word there means, hatik, but it seems to mean to cause to travel or something like that. So in modern Hebrew, the word has come to mean to copy something based on this usage. But it actually means the verbal root, ayin, taf, kof, means to travel in some form. And it's not the common word for travel, which is nasa, but it appears, including in Genesis, and that hatik would mean something like who imported, he caused them to travel or something like that. So there's an example where the Bible may be informing us of this. And I would assume that that's how these texts come into Jerusalem and eventually get incorporated into the Bible, which comes to us from that great center. The exiles who went off to the north, we lose track of them. We really have almost no references to them after the exile of 721. And the way I like to teach this is the camera of the Bible stays in the land of Israel and sort of waves goodbye to the people going off into the Assyrian empire, as opposed to what happens in 586 when Judah is destroyed in 586 by the Babylonians, and the temple in Jerusalem is destroyed and so on. The people are also exiled to southern Mesopotamia, to the region of Babylonia. But in this case, the camera, metaphorical camera, goes with them, because we have biblical books that are written in Babylonia, most famously and Second Isaiah, so that we are there with these exiles or the descendants of exiles, and that is why we never lose track. And in the return under Cyrus the Great and ensuing generations, Jerusalem and the temple are reestablished, and in that Persian period the Bible gets created in some proto-canonical fashion, but they still had all those northern texts with them, plus their own histories and prophets and so on. So it all gets blended in that fashion. But what's remarkable is that when the northern text came into Judah through whichever process, I've given one scenario, which would be the 721, end of the 8th century period, some of the forms might have been changed to make a more Judahite, but from what we have, there's still so much Northern Israel, Israeli and Hebrew there, that it's pretty clear they did very little doctoring, and we have all sorts of examples, grammatical, lexical, etc., which allows us to reconstruct. And that's how I got to this book, the Israeli and Hebrew, actually two books on it, one on the Book of Psalms, isolating a few Northern Psalms, the vast majority are Southern, and the book that really focuses most of all, the Book of Kings, where I lay out the differences between the North and the South. Right. It might be just helpful to give one example.
I was going to ask if you can give some, if any things come off the top of your head and some differences that you know between the Northern Israel dialect and the Judahite dialect.
Right. So one of my favorites is, students of Hebrew will know this, I have to learn this pretty early on, the verb lakach, to take, has an irregular imperative. So you say to a man, kach. So the lamed drops, which is the only verb in the language where that happens. And in the Elijah story, Elijah uses the feminine singular imperative, likhi. So the lamed is still there. Hmm. And this also appears in the masculine form in Proverbs one place, likach. So this occurs in Aramaic. In the imperative of this form in Aramaic, which remember was spoken to the northeast of Israel, the lamed is retained even in the imperative. So this would be an example of what linguists call an isogloss, connecting Northern Hebrew, Israeli Hebrew, to a neighboring language, Aramaic. Right? They're still speaking Hebrew, but they've got a grammatical feature which is known from Aramaic. But I love this example because it resonates absolutely wonderfully in Ezekiel chapter 37. So Ezekiel, which sort of brings us back to the style switching. Ezekiel is in exile in Babylonia, as I said, and chapter 37 is well known because of the vision of the Valley of the Dry Bones. Fine, wonderful story. But right after that, God tells Ezekiel, halfway through chapter 37, to take two sticks, two pieces of wood, in Hebrew there's eights, which they'll call it pieces of wood, and to write on the one of them, Judah, and on the other one, Israel. I'm simplifying how God instructs the prophet. But when he says take to Ezekiel for the Judah piece of wood, he says kach, the standard form. But when he says to take another piece of wood for the kingdom of Israel and write on it Israel, he says lekach. So God is actually addressing Ezekiel with kach for the Judean piece of wood and lekach for the Israeli piece of wood, and then he's supposed to put them together to form what we would call a diptych today, which is a metaphor for the reunion of all 12 tribes, both from the north and from the south. So there's just a delightful example of how the Bible just employs language, you know, time and again. Never, our attention is demanded from these very minor things. So that's a text, but he's self-consciously using the northern form there. So that's a really good example, and we know it's northern because of the story going back to Elijah and one passage in Proverbs.
I mean, are there enough examples of that where it's clearly a pattern and it's clearly that you're looking at two different dialects? Or is it possible that just like in Arabic, you can say fish and you can say mish and it has the same meaning of not? Just like in modern Hebrew, how it's obviously modern Hebrew is blending Hebrew over the ages, but just like how you can say different things, you can say anachnu or you can say anu.
Right.
But is it possible that was just a stylistic thing, or is there enough evidence there that we're looking at clear patterns?
So in that particular case, because we have it in the Elijah story, I assume it's just the northern form. And we can also justify it or because of the boundary with Aram to the northeast. So it's important that national boundaries do not create linguistic boundaries. And there's a blending. So good example, again, from Germanic. The farmers on the Dutch and German side of the border can speak to one another. I don't think a person from Amsterdam can speak to a person from Berlin. I mean, they probably could make themselves understood, but the Dutch dialects on the German border in the east of the Netherlands and the German dialects on the Dutch border in Western Germany almost blend. And so, for example, you know, when we learn German, ich is the word for I and apfel is the word for apple. And when you learn Dutch, ich is the word for I and apple is the word for apple, but in German villages along the border, they actually say ick and apple. I mean, if you ask them what language they're speaking, they would say German, but they are already using, you hear the phonology of Dutch in their language. So those are just really good examples of this. And I'll give you another example because it deals with Phoenician. So yes, it's not like the examples of Arabic and Hebrew, which you cited, because we can't show a geographical distinction there. they happen to be almost interchangeable and probably are in some way. So a fine example is the following. In Phoenician, the A vowel becomes O. So there's this famous Canaanite shift where long A becomes long O, and that's in all the Canaanite languages, except for Ugaritic, depending on how you classify Ugaritic. But in Phoenician, the short A also shifts to O. Hmm. And in addition to that, the feminine singular ending in T is retained. So in Hebrew, a wise woman would be Chachama, and that appears in the Bible. Isha Chachama appears, a wise woman. But in Phoenician, that word would be pronounced Chachmot. But that's singular. That's not, it may sound plural to our Hebrew ears, but that's the third. And I mention this because it appears in Judges chapter 5, where Sisera's mother is in the in her home, probably in the northern city of Hazor. And the text says that one of her wise women answers her, meaning her attendant, and the word there is chachmot, mm-hmm. which again appears in Proverbs. So it's the Phoenician, northern Israelite way of saying wise woman, not chachama, Judahite Hebrew, but chachmot of northern Israel. So in that case, we have a linkage with Phoenician. So you begin to piece all this together and you get all the evidence for the northern dialect.
Right. I think like it's easy for us to look at modern Israel and then project that where it's isolated from its neighbors as you know, and there's no real interaction and to project that onto the ancient world, but it really wasn't the case. I'd like if you can talk about who the ancient Israelites were, their emergence from the Canaanites and also the other cultures and peoples that were living in that area, because it all impacted the development of the language.
Right. So the origins of Israel, of course, are somewhat lost in the mist of time, but I know we can still reconstruct them. And so I've actually just written an article, Israelite Origins, addressing the question once again, which will be forthcoming in a volume. So let's take the core narrative of the Bible. So the core narrative of the Bible are these southern desert fringe nomads or semi-nomads akin to the Bedouin of today. And you have in the, regardless of the historicity of the Genesis stories, places like Hebron and Beersheba, so towards the far south of the arable land of Canaan. And you have the migration to Egypt and then the slavery and the exodus from Egypt and so on, and traversing in the Sinai and coming into the land. Okay, so that's a idealized narrative, but it's the national core narrative that they said that they spoke about over and over again. And the historicity of the Exodus account is a whole other topic. But since this is referred to in all biblical genres, it's obviously the core narrative of the Torah. It gets rehearsed in other narrative books later on. The prophets refer to it. The Psalms refer to it. It's all over the Bible. So that's the core narrative. And I think they were southern nomads. I think the core Israel were southern semi-nomads. You have these archaic poems which identify Yahweh, the God of Israel, with Sinai, Edom, Seir, all toponyms to the south, coming forth from Edom and Seir, as you have in Judges chapter 5 and in Sinai in Deuteronomy 33. And then you also get the same similar statements about God coming from Teman meaning just the south land. In modern Hebrew, it's come to mean Yemen, which is as far south you can go in that region before you hit the Indian Ocean. But in biblical Hebrew, it just means the south land generally. There were no national boundaries like today, so I assume it meant everything stretching across Sinai, southern Israel, southern Jordan. And that's where the Bible situates Israel. And we have some corroborating evidence, not direct, but indirect from Egypt, where they refer to these people as the Shasu, which is the Egyptian word for the desert dwellers and the Bedouin. So they make their way into Israel in a process of sedentarization. We can actually see this in the archaeological record in the 12th and 11th centuries, where they set up shop in the central hill country, which prior to that was basically open terrain. So in the late Bronze Age, 15th, 14th, 13th centuries, they're very sparsely populated area. And in the early Iron Age, Iron One, you see all these new settlements in the central hill country in the 12th and 11th centuries. Not only that, but the settlements are formed in elliptical fashion, which is to say they look like they're built, they're stone houses, but they evoke the Bedouin encampment. their tents on the perimeter, and at nighttime use the courtyard in the middle for the flocks, for the sheep and the goats. And those are the earliest settlements of the Israelites, and this has all been tested archaeologically. So I think the Bible's core narrative of having southern origins is clear. At the same time, this is where it gets complicated, there are elements that become part of Israel which did not undergo that core narrative. So we have some indication that the Danites, the tribe of Dan, would have been part of a sea peoples group that reached the coast of Canaan from the Mediterranean, probably the Aegean, and are probably to be identified in some way with the Danaoi of Homeric epic. We have some evidence to suggest that the tribe of Asher was always in the Galilee during this time period, reference to it in an Egyptian text. So there would have been elements, and maybe the tribe of Gad in Transjordan, there's a sort of one mention of them having dwelt there from of old, meaning since historical memory starts, and in a Moabite inscription, the Mesha stele. So it's very possible that these other elements were just, not possible, probable, that these other elements were not part of core Israel, but became part of Israel as the 12 tribal league came to solidify itself. And an American analogy comes very quickly, which is the origins of this country are extremely diverse. The core narrative is the English who came across in one particular crossing in 1620 and landed in Plymouth, Massachusetts, and we celebrate that voyage by the Puritans every year at Thanksgiving, and all Americans buy into it, whether your ancestors were on the Mayflower or not. Realize that there are, you know, a different story for the Native Americans. But America's history is much more complicated, obviously. We had early Dutch settlement. We had Spanish settlements in Florida and French settlements in Louisiana. And of course, hundreds of thousands of Africans brought to this country against their will in chains. And yet we all amalgamate eventually and become America. The core narrative is the one we all learn, the pilgrims coming to Plymouth. But similarly with ancient Israel, right? There's a core narrative in and out of Egypt, and the exodus from Egypt becomes the defining event. But the history of that is much more complicated, just like the history of America is more complicated, or any country for that matter. The ways of migration that create the modern country of Great Britain, a Celtic population, but then Vikings and Angles and Saxons and Norman French, and eventually you get something that looks like modern Great Britain, but it's waves of immigrations to that island as well.
And you can see it linguistically. In one of your articles, you give the example of the Hebrew word for iron is barzel. And you write about that not being of Semitic origin.
The word barzel is a fascinating word. I don't know if it relates to what I've just suggested. The southern origins, actually, we'll come back to barzel in a moment, but the southern origins might be seen with another metal term, which is the word for gold, zahav, which is cognate with Arabic.
Dahab, yeah.
And Aramaic as well. And the Phoenician Ugaritic, hence native Canaanite word, is a different word, charutz. And so which does appear in the Bible and does appear again in northern texts. We go back to that. But the dominant form in the Bible is zahav, which connects up with, as I said, Arabic and Aramaic. They may say Aramaic's in the far north. It is, but they also probably are on the northern reaches of the Arabian Desert, or at which point we start referring to it as the Syrian Desert. So there's a good example of a term that links up more with sort of south and east and desert side things. And there are many other words like that, by the way. I mean,
right.
Not with Arabic so much, but just take a common word like the verb to do, asa. So asa links up with Moabite. Again, southern Transjordan appears in Moabite. But the Phoenicians would use the word pa'al. Of course, that's also cognate with the Arabic word to do. So you always have to look at each word in particular. Just as a side note, by the way, this Phoenician Ugaritic word for gold, charutz, it's also the word in Achaean, eventually makes it way across the Aegean, and it comes into Greek, chrysos, which is the Greek word for gold, which has in the English word chrysanthemum, which means the gold flower. It's, I always like to point that out to people.
Out of curiosity, not to go too deeply into this, but so like the word charutz and the verb lachotz is like, in modern Hebrew, it means like to make like an etching into something or to make like an incision.
Right.
Does that, because when you're you're mining for gold, you're chipping away. I mean, is that, what's the origin of
it? Actually, I don't know where the modern Hebrew word comes from. It may be a neologism in modern Hebrew, something to write, because would a modern Israeli know the word charutz, meaning gold? Maybe, but maybe encounter it only in crossword puzzles or something like that. Some high level, high register poetry. I'm not sure. Zahar remains the word for gold. A little tidbit about one word which may, or in the verb asa, some of these words are, the word ear for city occurs in Hebrew and in Moabite, but doesn't occur in Phoenician and Ugaritic, where they use a different word, kiryah. So these little lexical items do suggest that there's something to the Bible's core story, even though clearly others who had links to Canaanites, Danites, Asherites, Gadites, who knows what other tribes. I mean, we can't say anything about the tribe of Zebulun or Issachar, just to give a few other examples. We know almost nothing about them. So it's a complex story. The word Barzel is fascinating because it's long ago recognized by scholars that it's not a Ado-Semitic word. We can match up the cognates for the word for iron, and they always have some problem for us. And in Arabic, it's not the normal word for iron, firsil, but it's apparently a rare word that means iron fetters. Mm-hmm. And looking across the Near East and across the Mediterranean, and we find that lots of words for metal start with the syllable bar or have the syllable bar in it. Bert is the Ge'ez Ethiopic word for copper or bronze. In Sumerian, not a Semitic language, Anbar means iron, literally metal of the sky, because the first iron they encountered was meteoric iron. Kubabar is the word for silver, so there's bar syllables everywhere. And remarkably, you go across the Mediterranean, and English speakers will know the word ferrum, the Latin word for iron, because Fe remains the chemical symbol for iron. Ferrum of Latin, we know it's actually from fersum. There was an S sound there first, and fersum begins to sound like the same B-R-Z of the Semitic Barzel in Hebrew. So it's a widespread word, and taking it always back to my beloved British Isles, the word Brazil is actually attested in medieval English for iron or iron ore.
How does that happen? I mean, just not just when we're talking about Hebrew, but languages in general, how does one word that's not native to the area just take over?
So this is what we call a Kulturwort or a Wanderwort, a cultural word or a wandering word whose origins we can't track. So wherever iron was first mined and became a metal for the people of the ancient world. And I don't know that anybody has ever figured out exactly where that is. We do know that meteoric iron was the first encounter with iron, the occasional meteor that reaches the planet. But the dominant metal, of course, was throughout the Bronze Age, as we call it, was bronze for good reason, until around 1200, maybe 1150, when you have the shift from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age. And iron smelts at a higher temperature, so the technology had increased. There's other reasons, which was that in the upheavals, the geopolitical upheavals of the 13th, 12th centuries probably made it much more difficult to get tin, which was required for bronze. Bronze is an alloy between copper and tin. Copper is found everywhere on the planet, essentially, but tin is very rare, and they would have had to bring tin from far away, including Cornwall, one of the great sources of tin in the old world in southwestern England. Southwestern Great Britain. And, you know, through all of this, it might have happened that the word Brazil got into medieval English as a word for iron or iron ore. And this doesn't mean that Hebrews or anyone like that got to Great Britain. But if we do remember that already in antiquity, the Phoenicians clearly had reached Iberia and probably went to Iberia sailing the Mediterranean for metals, where they would have encountered the Celtic population before Iberia was part of the Roman Empire. It was a Celtic-speaking population, and it went up and down the entire Atlantic coast, including, at that time, the British Isles. And so you can begin to understand how this kind of trade would, of metals and precious stones and things like that, would make their way across large swaths of land. I mean, we're always amazed to see how far, I mean, the farthest traveled item would be lapis lazuli, which is found only in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan, right.
the Himalayas, and we find lapis in Egyptian tombs and pretty early on. And then we find lapis in the British Isles in the first millennium, 6th, 7th century CE. Not BCE, I don't think, but unless the Romans brought it there. But in the 5th, 6th, 7th CE, we get lapis found in Great Britain. So it's just fascinating.
You have to imagine that when people found that in Great Britain, they must have looked at that and seen like what time period that would have come from and just, scratch their head and be like, what the hell is this doing here?
Right. And in fact, the lapis was used for illuminated manuscripts. In Ireland, the Book of Kells, which, well, we think it was written either in Iona in Scotland or somewhere in Giles, the Book of Kells, which is one of the most beautiful illuminated manuscripts, 7th, 8th century, somewhere in there, now housed at Trinity College Dublin Library. I think there's 40 or so different colors in the illuminations. And one has been determined by the experts who study this to be lapis. So, it's just remarkable. Right. Again, this doesn't mean that Irish people reached Afghanistan or vice versa, but through all the intermediaries, right? Persians can bring it here and then take it there, and then Romans can take it there, and Celts can move it there, and mention the Phoenicians sailing. So these words do spread in so many directions.
And then just
with the items.
Right. And just to go back for people who aren't familiar with the history of the region, the Phoenicians were Canaanites essentially. Related.
Coastal Canaanites of what is today northern Israel and especially Lebanon. So the two major cities of southern Lebanon today, Tyre and Sidon, were the two great Phoenician cities of antiquity. And from there, they would sail the entire Mediterranean.
Right.
Great interactions between them and the Greeks in particular, and eventually Carthage, very famous Carthage in North Africa, was actually a Phoenician colony. Of course, the famous what are called the Punic Wars, Punic being nothing more than the Latin way of saying Phoenicians, recorded in the Roman period. So there are constant battles between the peoples of Italy and the Carthaginians. And Carthage meaning, by the way, means just new city. So it means in Phoenician, it would have been like Kart Hadash or something like that, or Fenasha or something like that. Kart Hadasht, I guess, would be the Phoenician way. The new city. And this is what people did in antiquity, no different than Naples is Neapolis, the new city, and that's how Nablus gets its name in Israel, Palestine. Yeah.
Not to veer too far off, but were the Phoenicians, were they part of the sea peoples, or were they native Canaanites who were just seafaring?
They were native Canaanites who were seafaring. So the sea peoples we define as those people who left the Aegean and came to the Levant. And we know about them from Egyptian documentation, both under Pharaoh Merneptah, end of the 13th century, 19th dynasty pharaoh, and especially under Ramses III, first half of the 12th century BCE of the 20th dynasty, 1175 BCE. There, we have Egyptian records that refer to the sea peoples, and they give us names that includes the Philistines, not in the Merneptah, in the Ramses III material. The Philistines are mentioned, as I mentioned, a group that somewhat evokes the Danites of the Bible, the tribe of Dan, and others as well, a group called the Checker. So there's an alliance of sea peoples probably being pushed out of southern Greece and the Aegean and Crete by the expansion of the Mycenaean Greeks. And they move across the Mediterranean. Egypt repels them in both of these cases, although they inflicted apparently quite heavy damage at the time of Ramses III. Ramses III's inscriptions and hieroglyphic material and artistic material on the temple walls demonstrate the extent to which Egypt was under attack. And then they settle in the land of Canaan. So all of a sudden we get the Philistines. Again, people who know their Bible well will remember passages in the Bible where it refers to the Philistines coming to the land from Kaphtor. Kaphtor is either the Aegean generally or Crete in particular. Okay. And again, another beautiful linguistic thing, Kaphtor also comes to be the Hebrew word for the capital of a column in biblical Hebrew. In modern Hebrew means a button, but in biblical Hebrew, it's the top of a column. Why? Because that was Aegean-style architecture, and you bring the Kaphtor comes from Kaphtor, and it's not the Barzel necessarily, which we spoke about, but remember that when items travel from one place to another, they very often bear the name of the place whence they came. So Tor, top of a capital, is clearly an Aegean thing that makes it into Levantine architecture. My favorite English example is China. Very good dinnerware, porcelain dinnerware carries the name of the people who invented it in China, from which it was brought all the way across Asia into Europe.
So to go back a little bit to the Canaanite language and development of Hebrew, what was the Canaanite language, and did Hebrew develop as a distinct dialect of Canaanite?
So yes, Hebrew is a Canaanite dialect. I would divide Canaanite in the first millennium BCE, where we have the most documentation, a series of dialects, Phoenician, I would include Philistine, even though they came from the Aegean, they very pretty quickly adopted a Canaanite dialect, it seems. So Phoenician, Philistine along the coast, Hebrew, and in Transjordan, Ammonite, Moabite, Edomite. They were all dialects of Canaanite. And in the case of Hebrew, as we discussed, Hebrew could be divided into a northern and a southern. And they probably didn't differ that much from one another as the various dialects of English or German things that we've talked about. Notwithstanding differences between Boston and Texas, we can still speak to one another. May have to strain our ears sometimes. They may use a different word. The Midwest still says pop. In the Northeast, we say soda. But we recognize the difference, but we know it. Or the way Americans speak versus Canadians speak.
Right.
Slight change in pronunciation, right?
And did their location in the ancient Israelites, their location in the highlands, did that geography impact how that dialect developed?
I don't know that we can have evidence of that. I'm not sure that we can trace that in any way. Mm-hmm. I don't geographically think that something, because of their topography, nothing that immediately comes to mind that I can think of.
Right.
I mean, there are occasional words here and there that may bespeak something like that. Hebrew seems to have quite a few number of words for a spring. It may be because in those mountains, there's no great rivers and you just collect rainwater in cisterns, or you go to the local spring and that might be part of that. I mean, Hebrew does have also, going back to what we talked about earlier, a large number of words for desert. This was already noted by the great professor at the Hebrew University, E.Y. Kutcher, in his book on the history of the Hebrew language. So there may be some topographical things and geographical considerations which do enter into the language. The problem, of course, is for all these dialects, the one we really know is the one, because we have the Bible. And for the others, we rely on inscriptions. I'm sure the Phoenician annals, if we were able to, you know, have them, would be a great source of more information about the Phoenician language, but these were all written on papyrus scrolls and lost many, many, many centuries, millennia ago. We only can reconstruct what we have. By the way, and then the only question is, if you move back in time to the late Bronze Age, the 14th, 13th century BCE, what do we do with Ugaritic? I happen to think Ugaritic is the Canaanite dialect. Several other scholars write on this as well, most prominently Josef Tropper of Berlin. And others, such as John Hunegard, our very dear colleague, now retired from the University of Texas, believes it's a separate Northwest Semitic language. But we can still debate that issue. But there's a lot of similarities, regardless of how you classify it, between Ugaritic and Hebrew and Phoenician and so on. And that does take us back to the 14th, maybe 15th centuries BC. Right. It's a further historical trajectory is how all these languages developed.
Right. For people who don't know, could you explain where Ugarit was located?
Right. So Ugarit is in we don't really know what to call it. Let's call it far northern Canaan. Ugarit is a port city in what is today modern Syria, northwestern Syria. The large city on the Syrian coast, the Mediterranean coast of Syria there, is Latakia. And Ugarit is close by to Latakia. It's just an archaeological site. There's no modern site there. And it was excavated starting in 1929 into the 30s by the French, and then again after World War II through the 60s and 70s and 80s. And it has yielded thousands of cuneiform documents in an alphabet, however, not the Babylonian cuneiform. We actually have some of that at Ugarit as well. But an alphabet of 30 letters, so a slightly longer alphabet than we have in either Hebrew or Arabic, but clearly alphabetic and, you know, exactly like we can say Aleph Bet in Hebrew. You have the same basic order of the alphabetic. And it revealed, most importantly, literature of ancient Canaan. So it's got myths about the gods, especially Baal and El and Asherah and Anat. And then it had a sea god called Yam and a god of death called M. And anybody who knows Hebrew or will recognize those words, or in the case of Mote, also Arabic. And it also gave us epics about human heroes. So we have real good literature from Ugarit. It's the only literature from the greater Canaan world that we have outside the Bible. So as I said, you know, Phoenician, we get an inscription set up by a particular king or some, you know, trade document, ditto for Moabite, etc. Here we have real literature, which is what makes it so important. Even if it's not Canaanite, it's echoing the same literary ideas that you have in the Bible. And so this, it's a tremendous source for us.
Right. Okay, so also I wanted to ask you, earlier on in the discussion, we talked about when the canon of the Bible was written after the return from Babylon, Persia. When, do we see any evidence of linguistic influences from Persian or from that region in Hebrew when they composed the canon?
Right. So in addition to the two ways of slicing the pie that we've already discussed, which is to say written versus spoken, the diglossia issue, and then on the other hand, northern, or overlaying onto that northern versus southern, there's also the issue in the study of biblical Hebrew of what we call standard biblical Hebrew and late biblical Hebrew, LBH. So standard biblical Hebrew would be anything written before the exile in 586. Then there's a transitionary period, and people can actually speak about TBH, transitionary biblical Hebrew. And then there's the real late biblical Hebrew of the Persian period, 5th century onward. And in the late biblical Hebrew, and now we're talking about books that were composed at that time period, Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, Daniel, Chronicles. Chronicles uses older material from Samuel and Kings, but it's clearly rewriting that material in the Persian period. If not slightly later, some people would put it even. But those books are rife with Persian and Aramaic loanwords, which is to say, you'll be reading along and it's Hebrew, and all of a sudden, now you're getting real Aramaic words, not of the sort we spoke about earlier, which clearly are just for literary effect to give us the flavor of Aram, but just naturally using Aramaic words and Persian words, Persian being a non-Semitic Indo-European language. So you're getting these words that appear there. Remarkably, if you look at the standard biblical Hebrew material, and now I'm talking about the Torah, the five books, all of it, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, and the pre-exilic prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Hosea, Amos, etc., whether they were written in the north or the south or wherever, most of that is southern material, they are devoid of late biblical Hebrew features. It means, and not just lexicon, which I alluded to, but even grammatical influences and just of standard biblical Hebrew versus late biblical Hebrew is very obvious to those of us who work on verb syntax and other such things. All of that is devoid from the earlier material. So even though the Torah, let's start just focus on the Torah or Pentateuch, the five books of Genesis through Deuteronomy, even though that may have not become canonical until, let's say, sometime in the Persian period, I'll talk about that in just a moment, the language was not updated. So it doesn't have, there's not a single Persian loanword in all of the Torah. Aramaic words or phrases that appear, as we noted, are there for literary purposes. You won't find them outside the stories that are either set in Aram or the story of Balaam, the Aramean prophet, coming to the land of Canaan. So we know that this material must have been transmitted without linguistic updating for hundreds of years in the creation of this Israelite / Judahite / Jewish national narrative. And that's also true of Samuel, where you have the stories about King David. You just don't get any of this late biblical Hebrew influence. So presumably scribes preserve this material. Now, when we speak about a canonical process in the Persian period, two things can be said. First of all, with the destruction of the temple in 586, even though it was rebuilt starting in 538 and then dedicated in 516, takes about 22 years for the entire community in Jerusalem to get reconstituted and the temple to be rebuilt. In the Second Temple period, we see something new within Judaism, which is to say a more text-centered religion. I shouldn't say more, the development of a text-centered religion. So that parallel to the temple-centered religion, which would have been true of everybody in the ancient world, including Israel, in the First Temple period. That all continues. So you have the sacrifices, you have the priesthood, you have the worship of God in the temple. But you also get the development of what we call text-centered religion. And the classical account for that, or the paradigm account for that, paradigmatic story in the Bible, is Nehemiah chapter 8, where Ezra the scribe holds a ceremony in which he elevates the Torah, literally holds it up aloft for people to see, and actually reads from it to the gathered populace, which, by the way, is totally egalitarian. Men and women are both present in this. And you actually see the seeds of the later Jewish synagogue service right there. A platform is constructed on which he stands to read it. They interpret the story as they go along, exactly. And this is sort of the seeds of the synagogue service, which we don't know about for several centuries later, is built in there. Nehemiah chapter 8, the work of Ezra, dated to 450 BCE. So there is a developing canon. That was the Torah, the prophets somewhat later, third centuries, who knows when, right? And the writing section, the three components of the Jewish canon are Torah, prophets, and writings, maybe still later. And there's the whole question of how the canon closes and what's in the writing section. We're talking now first, second, even third century CE, before there is an official or quasi-official understanding that these are the sacred books and these are not. So it's a process. But getting back to the language thing, it's a really important point to note that we don't get Persian words or Aramaic expressions or late biblical Hebrew syntax in the earlier material. So this is authentically transmitted material from the first temple period.
So to you, that means that these were texts that were preserved for those years in exile.
The exile is only 50 years or so from Nebuchadnezzar's destruction of Jerusalem to Cyrus the Great decree to allow the people to go. It's 48 years. But one of the dark spots in our history is we simply don't know what they had with them in exile. Did they have texts with them in exile? The assumption is yes. Ezekiel, to be sure, seems to be in dialogue with the Torah, especially the book of Leviticus. Second Isaiah seems to know material as well. So probably had texts with them, took their scrolls with them when they went into exile, their most sacred possession, presumably, or what certainly became their most sacred possession. Mm-hmm. And remember, to quote a colleague, that when we study antiquity, all we have are islands of information in a sea of ignorance. So we're, you know, having to piece together an entire picture based on just little dots and spots here or there, right, and try to create what actually happened.
And there's no, I mean, is it too much of a, it's probably way too much of a stretch to imagine if, so in the book of Ezra, they find the Torah essentially like on accident, right? When they're rebuilding the temple, is that the main
story? That's in the book of Kings. Right. So
is it possible that they would have, if they wanted to prove that this really was from antiquity, that they would have written it in Israeli and Hebrew as opposed to what they were speaking at the time, or is that way too much of a stretch?
Okay, so let's remind the listeners of that story and then unpack it. So in 2 Kings chapter, towards the end of 2 Kings chapters 21, 22, 23, etc., you have the reign of King Josiah, and who starts to reign around the year 640 BC. So it's the closing days of the kingdom of Judah. They don't know it's the closing days, but we know it's the last half century or so of the kingdom of Judah. And in 621, there is a renovation of the temple. So Solomon's temple is now 300 plus years old. And Josiah apparently wants to engage in some sort of urban renewal, renovations of the temple. Fine, that's what kings, governments do. And in the process of that, discover the scroll in the inner sanctum of the temple, which the priest discovers, gives it to a scribe. The scribe reads it to the king. And it's referred to as the scroll of Torah, right? So the question is, what was found? Now, from the narrative in the book of Kings, most scholars, and myself included, believe that it's the book of Deuteronomy. So, and Josiah learns that, well, we're not supposed to be worshiping other gods because the kingdom of Judah had begun to worship other gods, including Josiah's grandfather, King Manasseh, who introduced the worship of Baal and other gods into the Jerusalem temple, in fact. And so there's this major reform program to rid the realm of pagan influences, all described there in those chapters in Kings. So the question amongst was, was the book of Deuteronomy written then? And that the narrative is nothing more than a pious fiction to try to show that Deuteronomy is much older. And Deuteronomy really comes from the late 7th century BCE. That's dominant view. I don't think it's a pious fiction. I think we should take the story at face value and think that there was in the inner sanctum of the temple a scroll of Deuteronomy and probably other texts as well. Remember that temples in the ancient world were libraries. This is where documents were kept, sacred texts were kept. We know that throughout the ancient Near East. And I don't think there's anything in Deuteronomy that suggests that it has to be a product of the 7th century. I think it could easily be several centuries earlier. Maybe, as I've posited, even the 10th century. But I posit that only on one particular passage, and that is the law of the king in Deuteronomy, where the king is limited to certain... The power of the king is limited, and we're told the king cannot do three things: multiply his wives, multiply his gold and silver, and not engage in a horse trade with Egypt. Well, those are the three things Solomon did. So it seems to me that the Deuteronomy is a reaction to the abuses of Solomon in the middle of the 10th century BCE, and so I might date Deuteronomy to the waning decades of the 10th century BCE, but I can only really do it on that one passage. And the again, American analogies are always very, very helpful. The 25th Amendment of the Constitution, wake of what people saw as the abuses of Franklin Roosevelt, who served four terms, well, he didn't complete his fourth term. So that should never happen again. Terms were limited to two terms. So 3,000 years from now, when people look back on American history, they'll realize that, oh, this is clearly from the mid-20th century to ensure that this never happens again. That you don't get elected four times. Similarly, I think the law in Deuteronomy concerning the king is a reaction to Solomonic abuses, and no other king that we're told of had such similar practices. So these are just some thoughts that can't be proved or disproved. Right. So, but that story is, to what extent, how, regardless of how historical that story is, it's a good reminder that texts do reside in temples and you know, can be read by priests and scribes.
Right.
And yeah.
Are there any from, to go back to the Persian loan words that made it into late biblical Hebrew? Are there any that have persisted to the modern day that made it through time and were incorporated into modern Hebrew?
Oh yes, and one of the best is the word dot. So dot in modern Hebrew means religion. But there is no real word for religion in the ancient world. Mm-hmm. You were just X. You were a member of this people, and you worship according to the way that people worship, and so on. So there's no real need for a word for religion yet. But dot is a Persian word, and actually means that which is given. And our English word data is from the same Indo-European root. And in biblically, it tends to mean more law. Then you actually get this expression dat vadin, which I don't recall if it appears in biblical Hebrew like that, but dat vadin meaning law and law or something like that. Din, a native Semitic word, and dat, this Persian loan word. So there's a good example of a Hebrew word that continues down to the present day, although its meaning has shifted a little bit, but it's a word
that everybody reckons. I never would have made the jump from dat to data.
Right. Now, so, I'm doing this from memory, but I'm pretty sure that that's correct. And our Indo-Europeanist colleagues will have to confirm that for me, but I'm pretty sure that's the case.
So when it comes to deciphering ancient Hebrew, I mean, how much is left to be done? How much remains to be deciphered, and how much are we just never going to know?
So what we always hope for are new inscriptions. The inscriptions tend to be short. We don't have any Hebrew inscriptions of the length. We don't have any of the length, for example. I think the longest inscription that we have from the area is the Mesha stele found in south central Jordan in 1868, Mesha of Moab. which mentions Israel and mentions Yahweh and mentions Omri, the king of Israel. And at the end of it, according to the latest readings, actually refers to the kingdom of Judah as Beit David, the house of David, which we also know from a different inscription in Aramaic from Tel Dan, but it's now pretty clear that it's also in the Mesha inscription, based on new photography of the bottom part of the inscription, which is difficult to read, conducted by scholars in Paris. So we don't have anything like that in ancient Israel. We have hundreds of inscriptions, but they all tend to be very short. They tend to be ephemeral things, lists on ostraca, inscribed pieces of clay, seals of the owner of the seal, and or the bulla, which would be the clay impression of the seal bearer, which have been preserved. We have two pieces of papyri, by the way, from ancient Israel, which were found in the Judean desert, not related to the Dead Sea Scrolls, which come from a later time period, but from the biblical period. One of them found in a real excavation in 1951. So we have, this again, it's a list of names and a letter. So, you know, nothing of great monumental importance, but adds another picture, piece to the puzzle. And the other one found, quote unquote, recently, because it turned up on the antiquities market, and it's a tag which is apparently accompanying jars of wine that were being delivered from some cave in the desert to Jerusalem. Not found in an excavation, so there's always the possibility that it's a forgery.
Right.
The experts have more or less confirmed that it's real. Whether it is or isn't, those are just two little pieces of papyrus. So again, as I said about the Phoenicians, true of the Hebrews, their literature would have been written on papyrus scrolls. Parchment doesn't come around until the 5th century BCE, at which point it replaces papyrus in the Near East, except in Egypt, where they continue to write on papyrus scrolls because they had the reed plant so plentiful. So we need more inscriptions. That would be the way to open up more study of Hebrew. But here's the point. Another article that I have written. I wrote an article once called "No Stele, No Queens," and it appears in the Festschrift for Eric Myers. Go back to where we started the conversation. Who was one of my teachers as an undergraduate in the field of Jewish studies, and I went to UNC, and Eric taught at Duke for his whole career. Recently retired. But there was a single program in Jewish studies between UNC and Duke, so I was taking courses with Eric. And in the volume in his honor, I wrote an article called "No Stele, No Queens." Half of the article is why there are no stele from ancient Israel, which is a fascinating point. So we have, by a stele, I mean a royal monumental display inscription, as we call them. So we have them in Aramaic from Tel Dan. We have them in the Mesha stele found in Deban in Jordan. We have a Philistine one from Ekron in the land of modern Israel. We have Phoenician ones, as I mentioned, set up by Phoenician kings. So all around the edges, but we don't have any royal inscriptions from David, Solomon, or any of the dozens of kings of Israel and Judah. And it's not like we haven't excavated. We've excavated, obviously, Jerusalem. But in the north, we've excavated the capital cities of Shechem and Samaria, the major cities of Hazor and Megiddo, for decades. And 150 years of archaeology has yielded no inscriptions from kings of Israel or Judah. And I actually think that that's intentional, or I don't think there's a coincidence here. I think that there probably was a primacy, looking at the biblical text, placed on humility and modesty. And I don't think the kings actually set up royal monumental display inscriptions, which would be a too boastful thing to do. So that is that's the state of archaeology today. As I conclude that article, or that half of the article, I say something like, you know, if in fact an archaeologist should find a royal monumental display inscription in Jerusalem or Samaria or somewhere, I'll be the happiest person there is, because it'll give us so much more Hebrew to work on, hopefully. But I don't think we're ever going to find one. I think that there was, even the great wicked king Ahab, we're told, humbled himself before God, the prophet Elijah. So about the biblical tradition, which I think is a real thing in the real world of ancient Israel, I think that explains why we don't have these inscriptions. By the way, one of the great events of the Bible is Hezekiah's building. I overstate, not a great event of the Bible, but it's mentioned in the Bible. It's Hezekiah's building the tunnel, which brought water from the Gihon Spring in Jerusalem to a pool, mentioned in the book of Kings and Isaiah and later on in Chronicles. So that's the kind of thing that Near Eastern kings boasted about. We have Assyrian kings boasting about their waterworks. We have the king of Ammon in an inscription boasting of his waterworks. And the Moabite Meshastil does mention this as well. And what inscription do we have in Hezekiah's tunnel? We have something carved into the wall of the tunnel near its southern entrance or southern exit near the pool. And it was carved in there by the workers. It doesn't mention Hezekiah by name. It just memorializes the work that was done by the workers that no one's ever going to see because it's in the tunnel. That inscription was removed and it's now in the Istanbul Museum called the Siloam Tunnel Inscription. So I think that's a, I use that example to show that the kings didn't put up inscriptions. You know, they didn't want to boast of their works, but the workers wanted to commemorate what they had done. And so either one of them or a scribe came in and incised into the walls there what they'd done and how many cubits long the tunnel is and how the water flowed and how it was constructed. So, yeah, we continue to hope for more information from ancient Israel, Israel and Judah in the form of excavations. And, you know, Eilat Mazar is doing great work excavating the city of David in Jerusalem where the palace stood not only in David's day, but down through the end of the kingdom, and finds little bits here and there, but nothing, no great inscriptions.
So kind of related to that point, I had Professor Aaron Rubin on a while back, and we spoke about the modern South Arabian languages and also modern Arabic, but we briefly discussed how by examining these other Semitic languages, some of which haven't changed for a long time, like modern South Arabian languages, it's possible to reconstruct what some of the original meanings of the ancient Hebrew texts were. And in our email back and forth, we were discussing some examples to give of that, of looking at a word in Arabic and what it would have meant in biblical Hebrew. And I'd love if you can give an example of that.
Well, my favorite one is a scatological example. As one of my colleagues once said, it's nice to talk about the Bible, not always in terms of eschatology, but occasionally in scatology. So you have this Hebrew word lasuach as a verb and a noun, siach, spelled with a sin for those who know Hebrew. Its Arabic cognate accordingly would be shukh, which in Arabic means urine or feces or excrement generally. And it occurs in two places in the Bible. The verb, lasuach, occurs at the end of Genesis 24, a chapter which we spoke about, when Rebekah is returning with Abraham's servant from her homeland to meet Isaac for the first time. It tells us that it was towards evening, lifnat erev, and Isaac went out, lasuach basadeh, to do something in the field. So, you know, the later rabbis, of course, had, you know, a challenge with what this means, and they came up with all sorts of examples, all sorts of interpretations. It sounds like a Hebrew word that means to have a conversation.
Right.
Discourse, modern Hebrew, sicha, is a conversation. They say, well, Isaac was, you know, contemplating, or he was having a conversation with God. These great rabbinic interpretations of this 2,000 years after the text was written. I think it simply just means he went out to urinate in the field because it's before you're going to go to bed or go to sleep. We shouldn't say bed. They didn't have beds. They slept on blankets on the floor, like modern Bedouin sleep in their tents. And probably that's all it was. It was a matter of fact thing that one does at evening time before one retires. People don't stay up after sunset because you might have a small oil lamp, but that would be about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's where that's what it means there. Again, we would only know it from its Arabic cognate.
Right.
But their usage, which is really fascinating, and it brings us back to your Ugaritic material, is in the Book of Kings, in the great, very famous scene of Elijah contesting with the prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel in 1 Kings chapter 18. So they're each supposed to take a bull and sacrifice it. There's a drought. So whichever, they're supposed to bring rain. And the prophets of Baal go first. And no matter what they do, Baal doesn't answer them. So Baal's a storm god in the Canaanite pantheon. We know this, especially from Ugaritic material. And nothing's happening. So Elijah taunts them. And he says about Baal, Kisiach v'kisiglo. Okay, maybe he has a siach and a sieg. And what do those words mean? So sieg is the Hebrew word for dross, the stuff that moves aside when you work with silver, the unusable part of it, or any other metal. And that would mean like a metaphor for excrement, the unusable stuff, right? And siach, I think, is the word there for excrement as well. So maybe Baal, he says, maybe he's sleeping. First, I go back a moment. He says, maybe he's sleeping. Maybe he's on a journey. And I think the journey probably means, like, when we say in English, I have to go.
Right.
I could go to the loo. And then kisiach v'kisi. What's fascinating about this is that when you go to Ugaritic material, it turns out not to be Baal. It turns out to be the god El in Ugaritic myths. There is a story about where El flounders in his own excrement. Remember, we think of God, of course, as the God of Israel, but the ancients saw their deities in very human form. So all the actions and elements of human life are cast onto the world of the divine. So El, you know, gods are born, gods die, gods fight, gods marry, gods sleep. Gods procreate, and yes, gods eat and drink, and also according to use the facilities. So we actually have a statement about a Canaanite god doing this. And even though it's El, it's very possible that Baal in the Bible is a bit of a fusion between Baal and El. So it's a fantastic thing. Elijah is mocking, you know, the god. Maybe he's had to go to the loo, and therefore he's not able to produce rain for the fertility of the soil.
I don't know if you've had a chance to read Ed Greenstein's recent translation of the Book of Job, but I had him on and we talked about it. And his book is just peppered with footnotes that are really pretty great. Where when you read it, he's talking about what this expression or this symbolism would have meant in the ancient world. So when we read it in English, it means nothing. But in the Near East, it had all those things. You know, had very significant meanings, and you talk about that in one of your papers when it comes to washing and new clothing, and it's a Mediterranean expression or symbol. But I'd like if you can touch on that.
Right. So Ed Greenstein is a very close colleague, and I will admit I haven't read the translation. I have the translation. I've owned the translation. I read the pattern, of course, looked up sample passages, and it will always now be the go-to place when I need to consult something in the Book of Job, which is the most inscrutable book of the Bible. And just kudos to Ed for having devoted now, I think, 20 years to working on the book, whose language is by far the most difficult of any book in the Bible. And in addition to the translation, a full-fledged commentary I know he's working on. Which will be near to its publication. And he's right, there are these phrases. So, you know, the washing of clothes. So I can't take any originality for this except maybe one little thing. This goes back to the work of my teacher, whom I mentioned earlier, Cyrus Gordon. Gordon worked on the interaction between ancient Israel and ancient Greece, or the ancient Near East and ancient Greece, I should say, more generally, just Israel. And he noted that a number of motifs that appear in the Bible and other ancient Near Eastern literatures also appear in Greek epic, especially in Homer, the oldest Greek material we have. So there's something called the nostos, the Greek word nostos, meaning the homecoming, the English word that is based on that is our word nostalgia. So the homecoming is when a hero has to travel and then eventually comes home, and it's always the return home. You have this throughout the ancient Near East. So the classic example, of course, is Odysseus, who at the end of the Trojan War has to go journey for 20 years until he returns to Ithaca to be reunited with his family. But you have this in the Gilgamesh epic, and you have this in two Egyptian tales, the tale of Senuhe and the tale of the shipwrecked sailor. We also have it in a third Egyptian tale, the tale of Wenamun, except the end of the tale is missing, but we assume Wenamun returned home safely. So in the Bible, the great journey motif, cum nostos, or homecoming, is the entire story of Israel. So you have the people as a whole going down to Egypt and then coming back through the desert. And it's the episodic journey, just like Odysseus's journey, which is the best known of all these. It's the episodic journey, and things happen. You journey to the next place, and eventually you come home. So Gordon noted that the washing of clothes or the changing of clothes is all part of that motif. And it's used to great effect by Homer, in particular with Odysseus. In the story of Senuhe, when he's an Egyptian nobleman who traversed the Sinai, goes to live, and eventually he comes back to Egypt at the end of the story. And he says he removed the sand from his feet. And any of us who've ever traversed the desert know how sandy we get in our sandals. And he removed the sand from his feet, and he bathed, and he washed, and he put on new linen clothing, again, looking like an Egyptian nobleman. And that was his return home, right? He's now home again. So this would have been known to the people. And in ancient Israel, you get it in the Jacob story. So Jacob's a mini version, right? Jacob goes and lives, as we talked about, leaves Israel, Canaan, goes, lives in Aram, and then eventually returns in Genesis 35. So in that story, you actually have the washing of the clothes as well. It's Jacob's mini. And by the way, he was also away for 20 years, whether that's a coincidence with Odysseus's 20 years away from Ithaca, you know, perhaps, we don't know. Mm-hmm. It's also the biblical 40, a typical idealized number in the Bible. In Deuteronomy, when the Israelites are ready to return home, you have a statement that their clothes never wore out. And v'lo balu simlo tehem, I'm quoting it correctly, their clothes never wore out. I think that's the same motif. They didn't have to change their clothes. They didn't have to wash their clothes, no matter how many years they were away. It's, again, God's hand in human history there. As they're on the doorstep of Canaan, waiting to return to the land, you are waiting for that nostos moment where they have to change their clothing. But I think it says that both their shoes, meaning sandals, and their clothes did not wear out. So these would all be very, as you said, you know, evocative, and the whole ancient Eastern Mediterranean background of this would have been known to the readers.
Right.
Always meaning listeners.
Right. And when did Aramaic overtake Hebrew as the primary spoken language in the area?
So Aramaic begins to spread remarkably already in the Assyrian Empire, and then in the Babylonian Empire, even more so in the Persian Empire. Aramaic has a really unique history. To the best of my knowledge, it is the only language which spread and became a bit of a lingua franca, not through conquest, but by being the conquered. The Assyrian Empire swallowed up the Arameans, just like it did Israel, and the Babylonians continued that swallowing, just as they did Judah, and eventually they all became part of the Persian Empire, and then the Empire of Alexander the Great, and so on. The Arameans never, you know, did territorial expansion of the sort, like the way French became a, hence our word, lingua franca of much of Africa and the Middle East. And, you know, English, of course, is the lingua franca today. Maybe we should start calling it the lingua anglica, where it's now all over the world due to the British Empire, New Zealand, South Africa, Hong Kong, U.S., Canada, etc. So this was interesting that Aramaic spread this way, partly because it was an alphabetic script. And so the Assyrian, Babylonian, and Persian rulers understood that there was a value for everybody who used alphabets and didn't have to use the very cumbersome Babylonian Akkadian cuneiform system for writing. So it spreads and spreads and spreads. By the time of the Persian Empire, it is the official language that the Persians use to govern the entire Near East. So we get Aramaic documents as far away as southern Egypt, just to give you a sense of how far it spread in 5th century. And educated people just start speaking more and more Aramaic. they have to converse with Persian authorities in Aramaic, and they start writing in Aramaic, and international trade and business happens in Aramaic. So eventually it just becomes the second language, presumably not just of the Jews, but of everybody else in the region. And then the question is, how long did Hebrew hang on before it died out as a spoken language? Some people think it died out pretty early on in the Persian period or the Hellenistic period. I'm in agreement with the scholars in Jerusalem University and elsewhere who hold that it continued to be spoken into the second, if not the third century CE. And the evidence for this would be letters written by Bar Kokhba, and most importantly, the Mishnah and other early rabbinic texts, which are being written in Hebrew, and not in a stylized, classicizing biblical Hebrew, but in what looks like a register of Hebrew of some sort.
Right.
So I think probably
you've written that,
and then eventually Hebrew dies out. Pardon?
Yeah. No, in many of your papers, you've written that Mishnaic Hebrew was a spoken dialect of Hebrew, like very clearly a spoken dialect, and that was a pretty late addition.
So, and of course, Jesus is always the paradigm example. A Jew living in first century CE, probably they, almost all of them, I think, would have been bilingual in Hebrew and Aramaic. Which, who would have spoken which at home, and who would have spoken more one more than the other? You know, maybe Belgium is a good example today, where almost everybody there can speak Flemish and French. I mean, there's a geographical divide, Flemish in the northern part of the country, French in the southern part of the country, but they all know the other one, and if necessary, can converse in the other one and learn both in schools, as far as I know. And I guess it's also important to point out, especially for the people who know Arabic, Aramaic remained the language. It was the Islamic conquest which brought Arabic to all of those regions. And so today, that whole area of the Fertile Crescent and beyond speaks Arabic. But into the 7th century, this would have all been Aramaic-speaking. Jews, Christians, others, Mandaeans, everybody would have been speaking Aramaic.
Right. And then on that same point about Mishnaic Hebrew and whether or not Hebrew remained as a spoken dialect during the Roman period, I'd read the Copper Scroll, which is, I guess, can be considered part of the Dead Sea Scrolls, but essentially it's a small, very tiny copper scroll.
Right.
Where, if I understand correctly, it's written in a pretty unique dialect of Hebrew that when they found it, they had no idea what it said. Correct.
That's correct. The Copper Scroll is just an outlier. It's an outlier in so many ways. Right? So it is found in one of Qumran, Cave 3. And unlike all the other documents, which are written on parchment and some on papyrus, is written on thin sheets of copper. And when I say thin, I think a millimeter or 2 millimeters, really thin sheets of copper incised with a stylus into copper, right? Mm-hmm. This is you write, okay? And found in one of the caves. It may not in any way connect to the Qumran community. I suspect it does not. And its language, as you say, is very different from the standard Qumran Hebrew, which is sort of classicizing biblical Hebrew, classicizing late biblical Hebrew. And then its content is a list of, it's a treasure map. It's a list of dozens of places where such and such is buried in huge quantities of gold and silver and so on. And encoded language, like a treasure map. You know, you go to the cave of the two pillars and go in 10 cubits and dig down to this far down, and you'll find this skull buried there. Well, you know, what is the cave of the two pillars? I'm making these things up, but that's what it sounds like. Presumably some cave that had some sort of natural pillar-like structure at its entranceway, which they would have known maybe, but occasionally places are mentioned, but there's proper names, so we don't know where these places are. They're in the Jericho region, but it is just a remarkably, it's an outlier in so many ways. And yes, its language connects up a little bit closer to Mishnaic Hebrew. It may be written first, second, third centuries CE. One of the theories is that it's the treasures of the Jerusalem temple that were hidden, but the Romans coming, to destroy it eventually in years. The Romans didn't come to destroy it, but it was destroyed. I should reword that within the course of the Great Revolt. So it's really it's a text that continues to have fascination. By the way, it's one of the Dead Sea Scrolls that is not housed at the Israel Museum. It's in Amman.
So I'd love if you can talk about what you're currently working on at Rutgers.
Well, with all of my love for the ancient Hebrew language, which remains just at the heart of all of my research, I have a whole new interest, which is in the what I call the brave new world of medieval Hebrew manuscripts. We take it for granted that all of our texts are in books because when we buy books, we go to the library, we see books, we are books, but it's all, of course, the printed book. But that's a modern artifact. So not until the invention of the printing press by Gutenberg, a movable type in the middle of the 15th century, do we have printed books. So that, you know, my copy of Lord of the Rings looks exactly like your copy of Lord of the Rings. And I can tell you to turn to page, assuming we have the same edition, and I can tell you to turn to page, 135, and yours will look exactly like mine, and so on. So before the age of printing, everything that we have from the ancient world was passed down in manuscripts. And this is Bible and New Testament and Quran and Homer and anything we have. And that's just our world, never mind the world of Hinduism, Buddhism, etc. And so I'm particularly interested both on scrolls, deep into the, scrolls are still used today, of course, in the synagogue liturgy. But even when Jews shift from the scroll to the codex, which is the forerunner of the modern, looking more like a book with pages and text written on both sides, I've just become fascinated by it, partly because I had the good fortune to spend various sabbaticals in the last decade and summers, both in Oxford and Cambridge, which are such repositories of material. And secondly, because of the worldwide effort to digitalize everything. So you no longer have to go to some library here or there and see something, even though I still do that, right? And I still go. Last year, I had the opportunity to visit the Vatican Library and look at Hebrew manuscripts as an example. Most of them are so available now on online that you can actually, and great digital photographs. We have approximately 50 Hebrew manuscripts at Rutgers as well, and we've just finished the digital project, and they'll be up available online sometime, hopefully within the calendar year of 2020. So this is my whole new enthrallment, and there's no such thing as look at page 135, Alex, and I want to read you what it says there, because every manuscript is different. The text may be the same if you're looking at the Bible in particular. It didn't change much over the centuries, but the way the text is laid out and paragraphing and all of the paratextual material and the marginalia, and I just become so fascinated by it all and the sort of discoveries. And I'm not alone in this. There's a whole world of scholars. I mean, a whole world meaning a couple hundred of us who are working on this, because we now have the availability to be studying these documents. And fortunately, they have been preserved in libraries around the world by these devoted librarians, mostly in Europe, but also we have good collections in the U.S. And this, in 2019, I was in Sydney, Australia on sabbatical, and I looked at their Hebrew manuscript collection as well. It's amazing. You can find manuscripts so everywhere from Rutgers to Sydney, with places like Oxford, Cambridge, and the Vatican in between.
Right. Well, please keep me updated on that project. I'd love to help spread the word about it. And thanks again for taking so much time of your Sunday to discuss this with me.
It's been such a great pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
Take care.
Bye.